Hi, and welcome to Forest for the Future, the podcast series where we explore ideas, challenges, and solutions shaping the future of forestry and society. In this episode, we are setting the stage for a three-part series on climate change and forests. Climate change is already reshaping forest ecosystems around the world, and forest management, policy, and certification systems like FSC has to adapt in response. This series will take a starting point in FSC in Canada, because they're currently already working on how they might include climate adaption in the Canadian forest management standards, and are also working on tools to support forest managers and communities. But before we dive into the details of what we are doing, why don't we start off by zooming out a bit and setting the scene? That is what we will be doing in this episode, where we explore how FSC understands climate change, the difference between mitigation and adaption, and why accounting for climate risks is becoming essential for sustainable forest management. We will also hear the Indigenous perspectives on resilience and long-term adaption, and discuss the often overlooked costs of inaction. In this episode, we are joined by Director General Subra Bhattacharya from FSC International and Valerie Courtois from the Indigenous Leadership Initiative. So, let's get into it.
Hi, Subra. Welcome to the podcast. I would like to hear whether you can start off by setting the stage for us. How is FSC, as a global organization, thinking about climate change and the implication on forest management today?
First, Loa, thanks for having me. This is such an important topic. We know that forests are critical to both mitigating climate change and helping people, communities, businesses adapt to the impacts of climate change. That is at the center of our thinking around climate change and forests. What we also know is that forests are getting impacted by climate change. And not all forests are resilient to those impacts. In FSC, we are looking at our strategy on climate and biodiversity because we know that those are very closely linked together. And our focus is threefold. First, that knowledge on the impact of climate change on forests has to be consciously gathered and disseminated. And that knowledge comes both from researchers and foresters, forest practitioners, indigenous peoples, communities living in the vicinity of forests. Second is best practices in climate-sensitive forest management, biodiversity-positive forest management have to be adopted into the regular forest management practices. And the third piece is that we have to incentivize the uptake of these practices, because these take extra effort and cost.
Mm-hmm. Okay, can we dive a bit more into that? Are you then saying that we as FSC are adapting our entire system to account for climate change and climate mitigation?
We in FSC stand for promoting responsible forest management. And we know it has been shown through very rigorous peer-reviewed studies that responsible forest management contributes to climate change mitigation through better carbon capture, better storage of carbon in forests. That responsible forest management leads to better quality of biodiversity, better ecosystem services. That is true anyway. But forests can be managed to very different purposes as well. We don't have to change our entire systems. What we need to do is to make sure that the best practices and evolving knowledge informs our standards. And by informing our standards, they get adopted into forest management practices in FSC-certified forests. That's how we make an impact.
Okay. But you also talked about creating incentives for this adoption to actually happen. Do we know yet which kind of incentives we're talking about there?
Sure, because when we talk of incentives, let us talk about the people who work in the forests, the forest's owners and managers, the communities, the workers. If you're going to keep a forest standing when there are economic incentives, for instance, to mine the land under the forest or to cut down a forest for agriculture, we have to address the economics of responsible forest management. A critical part of that is getting sufficient forest finance to the communities, to the smallholders, to the forest owners and managers, that they have an incentive to keep the forest standing, but more than just keeping the forest standing, to keep the forests healthy and resilient, manage it for health and resilience in the face of climate change. So forest finance is an incentive. Consumers who understand the value of healthy forests, not just to the people and economies around the forests, but who understand that a standing forest, a healthy forest, impacts and creates benefits for people living thousands of kilometers away from those forests, they need to incentivize responsible forest management through their consumption and purchase choices. Policymakers need to provide that support. So incentives could come from finance, from consumption choices, from policy choices. It is in advocating for those choices to create the incentives that FSC will contribute to incentivizing responsible forest management that is also climate positive.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so very much an indirect tactic of ensuring essentially a healthy financial model for forest owners.
I would not call it indirect, because when you're dealing with something as complex as climate change, when you're dealing with something as complex as forests, which are very different in different parts of the world, we do need interventions from many different angles. So direct incentives are the FSC logo in an FSC certified forest. That creates the demand pull, that creates the market access, and working with, of course, investors to invest in the ecosystem services. So I would very much call them direct incentives.
Mm-hmm. Val, I'd like to pull you in and pivot potentially to becoming a bit more tangible about climate change and the impact on actual forest. Can you tell us a bit about day-to-day on the ground in Canada? What are some of the most pressing climate change impacts that you're seeing on the ground, and how do they differ from region to region?
Yeah, well, first of all, Canada is a very, very large country. So climate change is affecting every region in different ways and at different rates and scales. But I would say the number one impact from climate change on the forests in Canada is the increase in wildfire, both in terms of presence, but also intensity and severity. We've seen huge evacuations. You might recall in 2023, 70% of the Northwest Territories at one point was evacuated as a result of wildfire. It's caused Canada to be a very large carbon emitter. As a result, in 2023, in fact, we were in the top four carbon emitters, sitting alongside the United States, China, and India in terms of those carbon emissions. And so I think wildfire is something that we're absolutely looking at and thinking about how we impact and reduce the risk of that. Subra mentioned carbon markets and other incentives. It's my belief that Canada should start really looking at wildfire, its responsibilities to that, and creating economic incentives around the battling of those wildfires. If it's outside of the range of natural variability, then to me, that's a market opportunity in terms of intervention of those fires. But that's not a system that exists right now in Canada. And so we haven't gotten there. We're also seeing much more kind of disturbance, not just wildfire, but insect presence. So a number of years ago, I'm still the signing forester for the forest management plan here in Central Labrador on behalf of the Inuit Nation. And we saw huge infestations of an insect called hemlock looper. It wasn't new to the region. I had asked the elders if they had ever seen this kind of bug, and they said yes, but never at this scale. There were always kind of individuals here and there, but we started seeing entire mountainsides turn red and dry out in the space of a year. The hemlock looper is a bit of a greedy bug. It bites here and bites here and bites here and ends up devastating the forest at a very, very fast rate compared to some of the other defoliators like the spruce budworm and other insects like that. So we started seeing that. We're seeing changes in behaviors of animals. So if I take the caribou as an example, that's a key species for my nation. Our whole understanding of our place in the world revolves around our relationship with caribou. Well, caribou are a really sensitive animal. They tend to avoid disturbances, but they, like us, really don't like biting insects. And the North has a lot of biting insects. And the more that climate change arrives, those insects are moving in to migration zones where the caribou are, and they're tending to change the locations that they are in terms of finding favorable wind conditions in particular, because wind will take the bugs away. And what we found is that caribou are starting to favor wind over good food, which of course will have long-term impacts in terms of the health of that herd. We have a situation here in Canada where the herds have declined significantly in the last 20 years, where some of them are, well, actually almost all caribou in Canada, with a few notable exceptions, are considered under a species at risk legislation. And so these kind of impacts are quite severe. And when I say impacts, that has resulted in us delaying the time that we go to harvest caribou as a result of these climate impacts. So I could go on and on about examples on the ground of these kind of things, but I think those are a few that immediately come to mind when you ask that question, Laura.
Yeah, and they're also like, they're big, right? I have one curious follow-up question to this, because I'd love to unpack your notion on combining carbon markets with wildfire protection. Can you just unpack that a bit? Because with a changed forest management, decrease the risk of wildfire, and that could lead to a carbon market? Or how would that work?
Correct. So right now, the carbon markets and the way that it works in Canada is that it only applies on what we call commercial forests, which is less than half of the entire area of the boreal forest in the country of Canada. And so within those forests, you can prove what's called additionality. So what Subra explained, that if you're, instead of harvesting, you're managing for carbon values, then you can show the market value of that change. Well, for me, if you are intervening and attacking a wildfire and therefore saving the capacity of the forest to continue to absorb carbon over time, and we've shown that old growth forests absorb more than new forests over time and are much more comprehensive in the kind of ways that they store that carbon, then we could be increasing the overall capacity of that forest to store carbon. That's been part of the reason why the country of Canada has been nervous about counting carbon, because, you know, historically, our boreal forest was absolutely an absorbent of carbon. And you can see models of this online where you see, you know, animations over time of the carbon flux around the planet. And when it's summertime in the north, you could see all the carbon get reabsorbed into the forest and then over time get emitted as the winter comes and wildfire seasons come, etc. And so if we are able to diminish the number one source of carbon emissions and then take advantage of the forest's ability to store and cycle that carbon, then we've clearly had a net positive impact on the global carbon budget. And so I think it would be a great opportunity to do that. Now, we've had arguments because the boreal is huge. And I don't get me wrong, I know how big it is. I fly over it all the time. And intervening in such a way will require quite a lot of resources. But it just so happens that Indigenous peoples in Canada live in these regions. And we have guardians and capacities. And Indigenous peoples have been unduly affected by these wildfires. More than 42% of evacuations in Canada in the last 20 years have been of Indigenous peoples because of wildfires. Now, we don't have 42% of Canada's communities that are Indigenous. That's quite an overrepresentation of the impact of those kind of things. And so there's lots of incentives for our communities to become leaders and active in the response to this problem. The other piece is we can also, as Subra had pointed out, manage for fire resilience. And historically, we have not always done that. The boreal, there was an effort of clear cutting and equalizing the forest to optimize economic returns on that forest. Well, that has increased its vulnerability to wildfire. And so we do have to think about this. You know, we saw this in Labrador with the entire hillsides that were red. Well, guess what? They were much more vulnerable afterwards to wildfire and to spreading that wildfire to other healthy forests as a result. So that's what I mean by there's a huge opportunity for action here, and there's a huge opportunity to create an incentive around this for Indigenous communities in particular who live in these regions that are capable of responding. But we're not there yet as a country. And I hope we do get there.
Mm-hmm. I have something that's tickling in my mind, and I will now be revealing the fact that I am not a forester. But if we can manage for wildfire by managing our forest differently, could we also manage for buck, not buck protection, but for stopping the spread of some of these bugs as well? And could that also be?
Yeah. I know Subra wants to jump in too, but absolutely, because these bugs have preferences. They, like us, you know, there's certain plates of food that I really, 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 really like. The same is true of those bugs. And so if you're thinking about the hemlock looper, they will eat conifers, but they're not very keen on deciduous trees. So now they fly, but there are ways of creating barriers and complications for them in terms of their movement through forest management choices. But when you're thinking about economics, and this is the thing in Canada, if you look at the Forest Act and every one of the provinces here, and each one of the provinces dictate their own forestry system, according to our constitution, the number one thing, they're kind of like the modus operandi, is to maximize the economic return of the forest for the benefit of the province. Well, if that's your prime directive, then you're clearly going to have choices. I think we, in the long term, if we want true sustainability, we have to think about what needs to stay in these forests for us to continue to be who we are and support all communities, not just human ones, but also animals and insects and plants, etc. And then what can we do to enhance those things through activity? And then what's left over that we may want to kind of harvest. And I got to say, if we were to readjust that as a whole, it would reduce the amount of harvesting. We've been over harvesting in general. However, it would increase the resilience of our forests, and it would increase opportunities for our communities to benefit from them.
So I wanted to come in and kind of pull together two things that Valerie mentioned and relate them to the question you asked on the economics of carbon markets. Mm-hmm. We know that globally, forests sequester, capture, and store about 16 billion metric tons of carbon every year, on average. Forests emit, give or take, 8.45 billion metric tons every year. So in the net, the world's forests store about 7.6 billion hectares. Part of what is happening through climate change is that temperatures are rising, but also rainfall, the humidity in the rainforests, that is coming down significantly, which makes the forests more drought prone. You heard Valerie say that Canada has always had wildfires, but it is increasing. What we have not had earlier and is happening now is that in tropical forests, we are getting wildfires. That is not a normal thing to have. If you remember in 2023, over 2 million hectares of forests got lost in Latin America, a lot of it in Bolivia because of wildfires. This is pure climate change. But when things like this happen, the net carbon stored in forests comes down. And that is fueling climate change. And that is, again, it's that vicious cycle. As climate change is accelerating, you have more forest fires, which is leading to more emissions, less storage, and hence more climate change. And of course, there are other things that muddy the waters here. There are other factors that influence. Forests have other values in addition to storing carbon. Biodiversity, air and water quality, ecosystem services that help us adapt to the impact of climate change, and among them, managing water cycles. So what you heard Valerie say very briefly is she talked about land relationship plan, caring, bringing in a spirit of stewardship and the values that FSC stands for. Now, when we talk about, you know, in the context of economics, in the context of markets or in science, this seems like these are not concrete things, but these actually are very concrete things. Values, caring, they are actually internalizing what we call in economics language externalities. These are values for which markets do not yet exist. So regulating water cycles, there's no market for it yet. Forest Stewardship Council, under its Verified Impact Program, quantifies the benefits for water quality with the expectation that we can get investors to come and invest in that. But there is no international market for it. So if indigenous peoples living in the forests or in the vicinity of forests are voluntarily adopting forest management practices that are going to contribute to better water quality because it aligns with their values of caring with the forest, because they see themselves in relationship with the forest, it is internalizing those externalities that markets have not yet priced. And that is how I see a very direct connection between these ecosystem services, between the values, the relationship, and the spirit of stewardship.
Mm-hmm. That would then lead me to ask you to talk a bit upon the role of FSC in building those markets that you're saying today there is actually no real monetized market for these ecosystem services. How do you see the role of FSC in helping build those markets so we can put a value to the externalities?
FSC's strength lies in the very large number of stakeholders, individuals, groups, organizations who are part of our community. We have, 70,000 certificate holders, 1,300 members, some 1,000 professional personnel working all over the globe. These are experts. Within our membership, we have experts, including indigenous peoples, representatives, and groups. Using this big community, what we can do is change mindsets. We are not necessarily finance people. We influence markets through our partnerships. Take, for instance, Verified Impact, which is, in essence, a scheme for payment for ecosystem services for 7 different kinds of ecosystem services that forests provide. Soil quality, water quality, carbon, yes, recreational value, cultural value, all of that. You don't have a market for water quality, and FSC alone will not create such a market. What FSC can do is quantify those values, provide the information that markets need, and bring investors to our certificate holders who are providing those values. Bring direct funding to indigenous peoples who are stewarding FSC certified forests. What that means is markets are not necessarily the only mechanism for getting the funding. Where markets work is that FSC's logo brings an element of trust, and that incentivizes the practices that go into responsible forest management.
I'd like to take us back up and focus a bit on climate change, because the question is, well, what do we do about it? It really depends on what do we do retrospectively, what do we do about it proactively? And we often hear the terms climate mitigation and climate adaption, and they're used very much interchangeable, but in reality, they refer to very different aspects of climate change response, where mitigation involves reducing the greenhouse gas emissions and reducing our emission in the globe, or it could also be increasing the carbon sinks, and adapt then are these adaptations of our processes to actually counter some of the climate effects that we have been talking about. So there's a lot of different ways of responding. And Val, I'd like to ask you, can you give some concrete examples so that the listeners get that differentiation crystal clear in their head from a Canadian forest context? What is the difference between mitigation and adaption in practice?
That's a really good question. I mean, Loa, I don't know that we've really adopted both correctly in all regions. There are great examples of mitigations in the forest sector around emissions of operations. There's been, there's been entire efforts to look at transportation efficiencies and different ways of looking at how you can reduce your overall emissions through, even though you're harvesting. And that's been so-so as far as impacts. I mean, when you've got giant wildfires thawing permafrost, you know, it's kind of like trying to eat an elephant without having teeth. So there's a bit of that reality. In terms of adaptation, I have not seen very much application of policy here on that. Now, to be fair, these are not terms that I use in my general approach. In the Indigenous worldview, you do what you have to with the information you have in front of you, and you do what you have to reduce risk to what you know. Now, that in itself results in mitigation and adaptation actions and all that, but that's not the impetus for the action. The impetus for the action comes from our morality around our roles as humans on this planet, more than as a specific action to a problem. So, yeah, I think it's been a mixed bag here. It's tough for people to change, you know, and we're in an economic reality globally where people are having trouble buying groceries. And so if they're at the grocery store and you've got, let's use toilet paper as an example, and you've got 10 brands, three of them have the FSC logo and two of them have other logos that shall not be named, but have less trust, and others have zero. And you can imagine that there's a price spectrum for some of those. And so if you're having trouble paying for groceries, you may not have the luxury of making those consumer choices to create those changes. And we are seeing some of that here. People are struggling for their daily needs, and it is having impact on pushing for some of these kind of actions because they're just kind of resting on security. And I totally understand that kind of human trend, but that's a short-term reality. You know, we had our prime minister gave a rousing speech in Davos that has been well commented globally. But I did notice a glaring absence of the reference to climate change in that speech and the impacts of climate change on global economics and movements and societies and migrations and all of the things that were addressed in that speech. I kind of wish he had addressed that, especially given his own personal history in exploring climate change markets and all of these things. So we're trying to do our best in the conditions, but we could absolutely be doing more. And we need to start exercising genuine courage in the face of these challenges. And that's totally what we're seeing in Indigenous stewardship.
Mm-hmm. How do we get to a point? Like, what do we need to do to get to a point where we get a climate change back on the agenda? And is there anything from the Indigenous knowledge that we could tap into and lean upon in getting more awareness again?
Like the fact that climate change is so political and seems to be attached to certain partisan positions is hugely problematic, especially since it's not like climate change has discretion. It affects all populations, everyone. And in fact, it affects women and marginal communities at a much disproportionate rate to others. And so this kind of politicization of climate change is a real worry to me. I do think we have to continue to remind people of their own power and of the impacts that they may not have thought about as related to climate change. Like, why is insurance so expensive these days? And, you know, the average person may not make the link between their insurance rates as they're living in, you know, floodplains versus the reality of climate change. I also find that our media is not necessarily always helpful in that this kind of false dichotomy seeking in media where they've got to have opposing points of view and explore all this. Well, that's BS, excuse my, but there is like the scientific community, people who are in the circle, there's no doubt that this thing is real, that it's happening, that it's increasing, that it's risky, that it's costing us, that it's all those things. And I really wish that media would do a better job of actually representing the voices proportionally, as opposed to this constant effort of always having these dual kind of opinions and views on those things. We're also not immune here to anti-movements and the pull to the right, let's call it what it is, and genuine campaigns to kind of dampen action on climate change. This, you know, when we've got the president of the United States saying it's the largest hoax in the history of humanity, that's hugely problematic. And that is feeding these kind of anti-campaigns. And in that same energy that is feeding those anti-campaigns, we're also seeing in reaction to indigenous leadership and indigenous rights and titles. We had a case in British Columbia called the Cowichan case, which recognized title over what it had now has private properties in that region. And boy, has there, I mean, there's an entire political party in British Columbia now that is denying residential schools and the impact of colonialism on Indigenous peoples. So that energy feels very, very, very similar in those campaigns. And so we're trying to think about how do we respond to those kind of realities. And in the end, it's just about we can draw from Indigenous values and Indigenous stewardship and approaches. It's super simple, Loa. It's just be a good person. That's what Indigenous stewards are trying to do every day. And if there's one that other humans could take from that ethic, is just try to be a good person.
Well, it sounds simple, but in reality, it's absolutely not, because you have so many competing agendas. Is there anything that, from your perspective, that we could do now that we're saying, well, politics is a mess. We all know that. And the media is very bipartisan. Is there anything that we can do from your perspective to get more action, to get more focus? What would you suggest?
Yeah, I just think people need to continue to use their voices. I've been looking at the latest polls because I happen to work in social change and political kind of spaces. And, you know, we keep seeing this, the issue of climate change and environment is lowering on Canadians' priority lists, et cetera. Just because, you know, someone's worried about paying their groceries this year and say so in a survey doesn't mean that they care less about climate change and the environment. So I think those of us that know that our daily lives are affected by this reality, that our children's future is in doubt for some of it, then I think we need to continue to use our voice to advance that.
Supra, if I am to pull you in here, is there anything that you see that FSC could be doing? I mean, is there anything that we could do to make it maybe easier for forest managers to understand the value from an economic and risk perspective to start planning for climate change and potentially managing parts of their forest differently?
So everybody needs to plan for climate change. Every sector needs to plan for climate change, not just forests and not just forest managers. Now, the one thing we can be sure of in these times of uncertainty is that the uncertainty, the global volatility is only likely to increase, not decrease. The plans we make today might become redundant, might need revising 6 months from now, but planning it will be absolutely essential. What are we talking about here then? We are in a time of extraordinary global uncertainty. We've seen that with the discussions around the EU deforestation regulation. We've seen that in the discussions around the tariffs being imposed and withdrawn in various parts of the world. There is extraordinary economic pressure, and governments are under pressure to ease the cost of living crisis on their people, and that is beginning to show in environmental policy globally. But guess what? You cannot argue with a heat wave. You cannot wish away a forest fire. So those are things that all of us, all of society, and forest managers will need to contend with. For a forest manager, what it means is that due to climate change, the way the forests are responding to higher temperatures, to lower humidity, it changes. So the patterns of forest growth, forest regeneration, forest fires, those are changing, and there needs to be planning for that. There is also the fact that even though in most parts of the world, timber is traded largely in local markets, only a small portion goes to other continents. Commodity price volatility affects the demand for timber in local and international markets. that volatility is not going down anytime soon. So what do you do in the face of it? You have to have multiple contingency plans, and you have to manage for keeping the greatest number of options open, which means now imagine a forest. It is different from a factory. In a factory, if your price goes down, you can just quickly reduce your production. Or if a price goes up, you can, within, say, a 6 month or 1 year period, you can increase your production. Trees don't grow that fast. You cannot quickly respond to a rise in prices or to a fall in prices. They take time, which means right from managing the forest for health and resilience in the long term to inventory management to how carbon and other ecosystem services are protected, all of that needs planning. What's more, we know what is one of the most time-tested risk mitigators, or what we know reduces risk: diversification, right? And this is in many sectors, in many contexts, we know that diversification reduces risks. Forest managers, therefore, need to take into account ecosystem services as other sources of value from their forests and plan for that in the long term. So this is where planning for forests is becoming more critical than ever before. Only one cannot be wedded to a plan. Plans will need to adjust.
Mm-hmm. What happens if we don't? What is the long-term or hidden effects of inaction in forest management?
You know, I would think of it in terms of clear, obvious effects and distributed effects. So you heard about the forest fires in Canada, and the same is happening globally. The pestilence, the drought-affected trees, the trees in water stress that are not growing as fast as they normally would, those are direct impacts that the forest owner, the forest manager, and the communities living there feel. The impacts that are felt by other people not in the immediate vicinity or not directly connected to forests are, for example, when your air quality worsens significantly, either due to a wildfire or because your forest has thinned, that has public health impact for miles around. People are not necessarily connecting the fact that there are respiratory illnesses because the air cleaning function of forest is not what it used to be. If there is water shortage, which is essentially one of the, let's say, central manifestations of climate change, water shortage, people may not necessarily connect it to the fact that the forest upstream has gotten degraded. But that is an impact. You might call it a hidden impact, but that impact will be felt by people quite far away from the forests. We know that the Amazon forests in South America, they sustain what is called a river in the air because they transport moisture, humidity up for thousands of miles. When the forests are thinning, the river in the air is drying up. The flying river is drying up. So weather patterns, rainfall patterns further up in the continent all the way to the southern parts of the US, the North American continent, all of that is getting affected, which means these are, again, not necessarily hidden, but nobody is connecting these to the forests in their day-to-day lives. The bottom line here is that a forest affects more than just the forest owner, the community, and the people living in and around forests. Forests affect many more people further away. We need to find a way to protect these values that the forests create, to get them funded, because we cannot demand that forest managers, forest owners, take on the sole burden of maintaining these ecosystem services provided globally without providing some kind of a support for them to keep sustaining these activities. And that is the critical part.
And when you say we here, do you mean FSC or we as a society? And in the latter case, what do you see FSC's role being in that needed shift?
Good question, because we as FSC for sure, but it is society has to fund this. And FSC's role here is that of a catalyst. Upfront, we know that forests involve multiple conflicting interests. It might be in the economic interest of the community, the forest owner or manager to cut down a tree or clear cut an area for the economic value of the wood. It might be in the economic interest to convert a forest area into agricultural land. But in FSC, through our voluntary certification mechanism, voluntary compliance mechanism, we are looking to create those incentives for forest managers to keep producing these ecosystem services and find ways for society as a whole to pay for these. We are also creating a platform for these conflicting interests, the environmental interests, the economic interests, the social interests, to come to a table and in a structured manner, dialogue, have those tough conversations that are needed to arrive at a consensus that is needed to keep these forests standing. And that is where I feel FSC brings a unique value to promoting, protecting the health and resilience of forests globally.
Valerie?
I think I could add that, at least in my experience for FSC, is that it's done a really good job of showing a pathway of what it looks like to implement the values that FSC puts up front. So let's say Indigenous rights. In the standard, at least here in Canada, it says that Indigenous rights need to be upheld, that Indigenous peoples need to have decision-making power, that there, you know, there is an absence of dispute in terms of the forest management, but it actually says how that happens and how you measure that and what that looks like. The same is true of high-value forests. The same is true of the ecosystem services. At least, you know, I've been an FSC auditor, so those were the principles that I know very, very well. But it, you know, in terms of water quality, for example, if you were to ask in a public process here in Canada, which is standard, the public has to participate and comment on forest management practices, and you say you care about water, well, that person doesn't necessarily know what that means in terms of forest operations. Like, how does a harvester care for water? How do we design our roads so that we are accounting for water movement? How do we think about the kind of forest cover that is going to be on that area over time? So it actually makes things really, really tangible in terms of that public participation process. So yeah, I think it is incredibly useful, because some of these things are a little bit nebulous for a regular person to translate what they care about into how they actually have to act in operations and ways of doing things on the ground. So that's been, I think, the most important thing about FSC in my experience with it here in Canada.
Val, I'd like to ask you, from an Indigenous perspective, as an Indigenous community leader, what is the role of Indigenous people in shifting that perception of the value of forests? What can you do? How can you help that societal shift?
Well, in a number of ways. One is, in Canada, as you might know, we do have an Indigenous chamber, which is one-fourth of kind of the governance of the model. And so there is an obligation to involve and play a leadership role within the FSC system at all turns, whether that is the development of the standards themselves or processes around the chain of custody, et cetera. All of those things are kind of present in the very structure of FSC. Here, we've had generally good uptakes. Some of the early certificates and some of the longest standing certificates in Canada are Indigenous-led industries and forest management areas. So we've, you know, punched above our weight in terms of influence there. We're also, as a country, really in a reconciliation process and in a legal kind of equalization process. So some of our provinces have adopted the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples and adopted that in through a legal framework. Our country, as Canada, has adopted that, has created an action plan around that. And while many of us in the Indigenous communities are a little bit impatient and we'd like to see some of these things happen more quickly, we do have principles in this country that have been established by Indigenous peoples fighting for them. And then I can't underestimate the leadership that came from our former Prime Minister Trudeau, who centralized the relationship of Indigenous peoples as part of his approach to leadership as a Prime Minister. Change happens from the top, and that really mattered and did create context for all those things. But there's lots of road to move forward. There was investments, for example, in Indigenous-led conservation and the establishment of Indigenous protected and conserved areas, and lots of money for that establishment process. You know, that's one part, but the actual hard bit about protected areas is the long-term management and how you create a financial kind of reality and an economy around these protected areas. And that part of the question still needs some attention and energy and focus in this country. And then the last thing I'll say, Loa, is that the Indigenous peoples have not waited for perfection to act. And then, yeah, we just don't have time. If you care about your grandchildren, then I can't imagine doing anything else but acting.
So to end the episode off, I'd just like to zoom out again and hopefully end on a bit more of a positive note or a call to action kind of note. If there's one thing that you would like for the listeners to take away from this conversation today about climate change, one thing that they can go out and do, one thing that they can integrate into their everyday lives, what would that be? Subra, let me start with you.
Act now. Do not wait for the perfect answer, the perfect solution, the perfect incentive, because there isn't any. Act now in whichever way you can. And there are many ways that you can contribute to healthy and resilient forests, and in turn, climate change mitigation and adaptation. Act for people and communities. FSC offers many, many avenues for people to contribute to promoting healthy and resilient forests, for people to contribute to climate action. Choosing the FSC certified products as a consumer, as a producer, contributing to our standards through your expertise, through your knowledge, through your research, joining us as members and influencing our direction, and talking about the importance of high standards of responsible forest management. All of these are ways for people to contribute. People need to know that when they choose an FSC certified product, it's not just forests that benefit. Forests do. But it stands for upheld labor rights, the well-being of workers. It stands for the rights of and voices of Indigenous peoples. It stands for the well-being of local communities. Get involved, do what you can, and do it every day.
Well, that was a tough one to follow. What would you say? What's the takeaway, the call to action that you have?
Certainly do what Subra just said to do. That's a great one. You know, make your choices and act on them. I think supporting Indigenous peoples is an important action. Look, we're 5% of the global population, yet we've been caring for more than half of the remaining biodiversity that is left on this planet. Support conservation, area-based conservation, that can get us to a third of the Paris climate target agreements, simply if we protected our forests, especially forests that have huge climate impacts. I mean, the boreal forest will absorb twice as much carbon per hectare as tropical forests. It's huge. Let's protect that. It's helping us. And let's think about how we manage these things. Also, in countries where we have the luxury of law and right and economic systems, Canada's in a G7, is one of the G7 countries. We have all the reasons to lead on this and to show that doing good things for the planet is also doing good things for humanity. And lo and behold, it will translate into healthy economics. And so I do think that there's this kind of global upheaval. It shouldn't be a race to the bottom. What we need to have is countries and people who are being brave and saying, we're still going to do it and gosh darn it, if we can do it, then maybe we can be an example to others and bring others along. I think those are the things we can do.
That brings us to the end of the episode. There is no doubt that today's topic was both a bit heavy and difficult to wrap our heads around. But we don't have a choice. We have to, because there's broad consensus that the cost of inaction on climate change are staggering compared to the investment we would need to do to support the change needed. If we do nothing, we are facing damaging costs of global societies costing trillions of dollars. But if we act now, various sources suggest that for every dollar we spend on adaptation and mitigation, $10 to $19 are saved in avoided future losses. So let us do as Super suggests. Act. Act now. It does not matter whether you're buying FSC-certified toilet paper in the supermarket, or whether you're asking your supplier for certified materials, or if you're getting involved in FSC as a member or join our processes. Everything counts. A big thank you to Supra and to Valerie for sharing their insights and experiences and for helping us better understand why adapting forest management to climate change is not optional. It's essential. This episode is part of a three-part series on climate change and forests developed in collaboration with FSC Canada. In the next episode, we will move from framing the challenge into looking into practical tools, focusing on climate vulnerability assessments and how they're being used to support climate resilient forest management in practice. Thank you for listening. And don't forget to subscribe to Forest for the Future wherever you get your podcasts. You're also always welcome to reach out to me on podcast@fsc.org. I am Loa Dalgard-Worm, and this was Forest for the Future.